Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Elaine Winters, counsel for Brittany Labberton. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
As I indicated, I am attorney for Ms. Labberton, who is appealing from a King County juvenile court order terminating her parental rights. Ms. Labberton is present in court, as is her husband, whose case is linked with this, but her being heard without oral argument later today. I'm assuming the court would like to talk about the guardian ad litem issue, but I feel I would be remiss if I did not mention that we have a pending motion to extend the time to file the notice of appeal pending before this court. It was, the commissioner asked the court to decide, and I feel I should at least briefly address it. This is a situation where Ms. Labberton's counsel believed that he had filed a notice of appeal. This is apparent from the fact that he, within the deadline for filing the notice of appeal, filed Ms. Labberton's specific direction to her attorney telling him that she wanted to appeal. And that was dated 11/28, which was the date of the order terminating parental rights. And it was filed on 12/22, which would have been before the 30-day deadline. After the 30-day deadline, he also filed the IFP order along with the motion, the affidavit, the declaration from Ms. Labberton describing her finances is also dated 11/28/11. And counselor's declaration, he indicates that he believed he had filed the notice of appeal because, I think he intended to and had prepared it, and also because the court docket indicated that it says notice of appeal mother. So he believed that the notice of appeal had been filed, and it was not until February that he learned it had not, and he immediately filed a notice of appeal with the motion asking for more time.
Let me ask you a question. The document to which you referred, dated November 28th, why isn't that a notice of appeal?
I think it just isn't.
Why?
If you look at RCW 13 and it's 04, the Juvenile Court Act, it talks about the right to appeal, and then it says, and then it discusses this specific direction as a separate item that must be filed in termination rights. I mean, I agree with you that if that were a notice of appeal, then we wouldn't have this motion, and it certainly would put the parties on notice, which might be one of the reasons why we have that.
Sure.
I do think that this fits the extraordinary circumstances where counsel had honest belief that he had filed the notice, and that it's the type of thing where we're avoiding an injustice. This is a case where not just property rights are involved, but important fundamental liberty interests, where Ms. Labberton had a right to counsel and a right to effective assistance of counsel. And also, finality of judgments just aren't a real problem here. The CASA argued in opposition that Rule 18.8 must be interpreted in order to preserve the finality of judgments, which is true, but the father, as I indicated, already had an appeal pending at this time. So going on to the next issue, which would be the responsibilities of the guardian ad litem. Guardians ad litem in Washington courts are governed by court rules, GALRs, but also in specific areas there are specific statutes. And 1334-105 addresses guardian ad litem's independency and termination matters. The statute was amended in 2008 to add a section that makes it one of the responsibilities of the guardian to meet with, interview, or observe the child, depending upon the child's age and developmental status, and to report to the court any views or positions expressed by the child on issues pending before the court. In this case, we're not arguing that the volunteer CASA didn't do the investigation that was required by the GALR2 or by other portions of the rule. It was this in which she seems to have fallen down. She did meet with the, she did observe the children, which was appropriate with their developmental age. She also interviewed other people, parties, foster parents, my client. She arranged for a therapist to see one or two of the older children and spoke with them. But she did not report the children's views to the court. The CASA argues that these children were too young simply to have views, and admittedly the children were 4 and a half, 3, and 1 at the time of the hearing. So doubtfully, I understand completely why the CASA would not report on what a baby had to say. But she did testify that the older child was in a position where you could, I think what she said is you could kind of get into her head, or you could kind of see what she thought. So it was possible if she had reported any statements about the case to report those to the court. Why is this not harmless? This is a case where there's plenty of testimony that Ms. Labberton loved her children, did an excellent job taking care of them during the visitation, and several people that worked with her testified that the children also expressed love for her, especially the older children. They kissed her when the visit starts. They were very happy to see her and wanted to sit in her lap, wanted to be near her. So this is a situation where the children's interest should have been expressed to the court. If the court doesn't have any questions, I will reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Okay, you'll have 4 minutes.
May it please the court, Paul Graves for Vanessa Allen, the court-appointed special advocate. I have Michael Collins from the Attorney General's office with me, but I'll be arguing for all 10 minutes.
Very well.
Ms. Allen is in the courtroom here today. The order under review followed a 9-day trial at which 17 witnesses testified. 5 professionals recommended termination. None recommended otherwise. The trial itself followed a 3-year dependency at which the parents received a multiplicity of services and yet did not make progress in remedying the very serious problems that brought them into the system in the first place and that prevented them from reunification with their children. Mrs. Labberton, the mother, argues that all of that must be negated and an entirely new trial ordered because the CASA did not interview a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old and ask them what they wanted to have happen in the case. There are multiple independently sufficient reasons to reject that argument and to affirm the decision below. The first is this CASA statute itself does not, in fact, require a CASA in every case to interview children and to ask them what they want to have happen. It instead requires 2 things. First, to meet the children, to see them face to face. In the words of the statute, to meet with, interview, or observe the child. The second is to report any views they express. That's not a requirement to elicit views. Indeed, the fact that the first requirement involves meet with, observe, or interview, depending on the child's age and development status, is a recognition by the legislature that every child will be different and that many children should not be asked what they want to have happen in their case. This is exactly the kind of case, and these are exactly the kind of kids who should not have been asked what they wanted to have happen. They've been out of their parents' homes for nearly their entire lives. The youngest child, indeed, was taken away immediately at birth. The oldest 2 girls' therapist testified at trial and explained that they had mixed and difficult emotions about the case. The trial court judge, Judge Clark, found that the second child, EL, had torn loyalties. The literature is full of data that children in these circumstances can have increased feelings of guilt and worse problems than they already have if they believe that they have some control in the outcome of the case, especially when they've been poisoned against their foster parents by their parents. This is exactly the kind of case, and these are the kids, for why the statute grants CASAs discretion in deciding how to interact and how to review the children. And the record is replete that the CASA did meet with the children and observe them. She saw them on visits with their parents. She saw them in their foster homes. She saw them with their service providers. All of that is exactly what a CASA should do, and the CASA statute does not require anything different. And yet, even if it did, any argument under this statute was waived because the parents did not ask the CASA about it at all or raise it before the trial court below. The CASA testified for a full half day and was fully cross-examined on several of the issues. The parents declined to ask her what, if anything, the children said about what they wanted to have happen in the case. RAP 2.5 and the cases underneath it explained that courts sensibly will not review issues that were not raised at trial unless they involve certain narrow circumstances. The only plausible one in this case are for manifest errors affecting constitutional rights. But this is a statutory challenge. The two cases from the Washington Supreme Court that most discuss RAP 2.5A3 and the waiver requirements makes clear that the challenge itself is what matters for deciding whether it involves a constitutional right. State against Scott and State against Kirkman were both criminal cases that obviously implicate constitutional rights. Yet the challenge in State against Scott to the jury instruction and the challenge in State against Kirkman to witnesses testifying about the credibility of the defendant were not constitutional issues because they were straightforwardly evidentiary challenges. This here is straightforwardly a statutory challenge. It's an argument under a 2008 amendment to the CASA statute. There's no argument that the Constitution requires that toddlers and infants be interviewed about what they want to have happen and their views reported to the court. RAP 2.53 thus provides a separate independent reason to reject the argument here. And yet, even if the court were willing to excuse the failure to raise this issue below, and even if the court believed that this were a violation of the statute, still any claimed error was harmless. Again, this was a 9-day trial, and every professional recommended termination, none recommended otherwise. That whether the young children believe something should have happened in their case would not have impacted the trial court's finding that the parents lacked credibility, or that they had failed to make progress, or that they had failed to fully engage in the services they were required to engage in. None of that would be impacted, and none of the 126 findings of fact in the 28-page order would have been any different if the court had been apprised that a 3-year-old said that she had some views on the case. Now, we do have a timeliness issue that we feel comfortable leaving to the briefing, but unless there are other questions from the court, we'll rest there. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, I would argue that whether a child in a dependency action has a voice in court is very much a constitutional issue. It's clear from MSR, the state Supreme Court case addressing the child's right to counsel, that part of due process, that the children, just like parents, and perhaps even more so, have a fundamental liberty interest in the actions in a determination dependency cases. Their interest is enormous. And what the court found is that the right to counsel, that children have the right to counsel commensurate with that given by the 14th Amendment to parents, which is a case-by-case basis determined by the court. And that's what the statute provides, basically. The statute provides counsel for children if the court feels they should be appointed. And one of the reasons the court found that is that we have a guardian ad litem present in court to represent the child's best interests and to report to the court about the child's wishes. I think the guardian gets in a problem. Obviously, the guardian can get in a big problem, and counsel may be necessary if those are at odds. But it's important that the court know what the child's interests are, because the CASA is the only voice for the child's best interests, and similarly, the only one with this requirement to report to the court if the child has expressed any views. The CASA points out that this can be very, this could be damaging to children. He indicates that these are children. This would be especially true for. I think it's important to remember that our CASA, our volunteer CASA, indicated that though she's a volunteer, she had 32 hours of training. That this is the kind of thing that CASA training would address. That the CASA would not probably sit down with a child with a notebook and say, well, what should I tell the judge? What do you want to have happen? She would be able to address the issue in a much more subtle way with small children, again, commensurate with their age and their ability to understand what's going on. And finally, the GAL's suggestion that this is harmful to children is, in some ways, a policy argument that should be addressed to the legislature, because the statute does say that this is one of the costs of guardian ad litem's responsibilities. But overall, I would indicate that this is, the child's voice and being heard in any fashion in court is a constitutional issue that can be raised for the first time in appeal. That is what happened in MSR. The issue of right to counsel was not addressed until appeal, and this is one that can be. Does the court have any more questions? Okay. I would thank the court for your time and ask the court to, again, grant our motion to extend time to file a notice of appeal and reverse the termination order based upon the cost issue that we've addressed and also the void for vagueness issue addressed in Mr. Labberton's brief. Thank you.